Thy Spirit, likewise, O Lord, leads us sunward. For we are thine by creation and recreation in Christ the Lord. We seek today the impulse of thy presence, the impression of thy presence, the power and persuasion of thy presence, till all of us prophets be, though the heavens fall, through Jesus Christ the Lord. Amen. Three years ago, Southeastern Seminary was able to announce and to inaugurate what has already become one of the highlights of our academic and personal and professional year. And that is the Theodore F. Adams Lectures on Preaching and the Practice of Ministry. In that inaugural event, Dr. Clarence Cranford delivered the lectures for the first time. Last year, Dr. Gardner Taylor continued that very fine beginning, and now into that stream steps Dr. Gene E. Bartlett. There are many of you who would agree with one in this room who said that if he could have picked anybody to have delivered the lectures in the year 1978, he would have chosen to select Dr. Bartlett. I agree with that sentiment completely. I think you're fortunate to be here, and we think you're very, very welcome here. We know we want you to feel very welcome here. We have numbers of guests from our community, from Raleigh and from regions nearby, and also some of you have come from some distance, and we welcome you particularly. There are two groups that we want to welcome in a special way today, and those are our alumni who are here for the Alumni Institute, the annual trek back to home and roots and academic flavors to update and to refresh yourselves. We welcome all of you who are here today participating in our Alumni Institute. The others are those who are in the Chaplains Conference. The Chaplains Conference convenes annually on our campus for 2 days during this week of lectures. I met with them today. They are an enthusiastic group, and a very large group, by the way, this year, representative of military, industrial, hospital, all kinds of chaplains. And in their conference, they are being very well led today by Dr. Dale Moody, and we welcome him to our campus. It was years ago, in fact, I think it was 1962, when I first read The Audacity of Preaching. I'd never thought of preaching having audacity connected with it until I read that. But now, ever since, I have thought of preaching being precisely like that. I did not know the writer at that time, nor the one who had delivered that series as the Lyman Beecher Lectures at Yale University in 1961. But now, having met him, I'm even more grateful that preaching has the audacity of muscle and nerve and flesh and blood of a person like the one who will lecture with us today. Since 1970, June the 1st, Dr. Gene E. Bartlett has been the minister of the First Baptist Church in Newton, Massachusetts. Prior to that, for 10 years, the decade of the 60s, 1960 till 1970 to be precise, he was the president of Colgate Rochester Divinity School. And during that time at Colgate Rochester, he was active in the formation of the Rochester Center for Theological Studies, which is a cluster of four schools: Colgate Rochester, Bexley Hall, Crozer, and St. Bernard's, which brings together the very finest traditions in one center for theological studies. In 1972, he served as the president of the Massachusetts Council of Churches, and in 1972-73 was the president of the American Baptist Churches in the USA. Dr. Bartlett attended Denison University and Colgate Rochester Divinity School. He was awarded honorary degrees by Colgate University, by Denison, by Kalamazoo, by Franklin, and by Ottawa. Kenyon College conferred upon him the LHD, and the University of Southern California the LLD degree. He's been a pastor in various states in New York, in Missouri, Illinois, and in Los Angeles, California, where he served as the pastor of the First Baptist Church. for me to tell you all the places, or even a portion of the places, that Dr. Bartlett has been asked to deliver distinguished lectures and sermons would be very lengthy. Suffice it to say that many college chapels, including Harvard and Princeton and Rockefeller Chapel at the University of Chicago, Yale, Vanderbilt, Andover, Newton, and others, have been graced by his lectureships and his preaching. From 1935 to 1960, Dr. Bartlett was the minister on radio ministry in his churches. While serving in the pastorate, he's always been close to theological education and higher education generally. He taught at Garrett and at Southern California School of Theology and at Andover Newton Theological School presently. Among his books are The News in Religion, published in 1947, The Role of Preaching in the Church and Mental Health, published by the National Council of Churches. And I've already mentioned The Audacity of Preaching, published in 1962. In 1972, he wrote, And These Are the Baptists. Then a variety, just an array of articles in the Christian Century, Pastoral Psychology, and other journals. His activities have been as busy as his academics. He has conducted preaching missions in the U.S. Air Force to chapels in Korea and Japan and Alaska. He served as the acting chairman of the Citizens Committee establishing Rochester Jobs Incorporated. He's worked with minority groups to provide over 1,500 jobs for hardcore unemployed in Rochester. He served on the interfaith mission to Israel in 1974 and 1975. And in the midst of all that, he's been a husband and a father. He and Mrs. Bartlett have 5 children, 3 sons and 2 daughters. And I'm not going to take any more precious time delivering the deliverer, but after the anthem, we will hear the first in the present series of Adam's lectures, Is a Prophetic Ministry Possible Today? Dr. Bartlett, I hope you feel you're welcome. It's kind of a miracle he got here. The Boston airport's been closed for a week. He finally got off the ground, overflew the national airport last evening in Washington, and got to Raleigh-Durham just at the time an airplane crashed. He's absolutely certain the Lord intended for him to be here, or else he just never would have made it through all the pitfalls. We welcome you.
Mr. President, I thank you for the gracious and generous welcome which you have given me on behalf of this community. As a matter of fact, it is better than one I received on an occasion when I went to be pastor of a church. Church in Evanston, Illinois, invited me to become the minister, and after giving it due consideration, I wrote a letter to the moderator and said I would accept. He wanted to, in turn, to be gracious, so he sent me a telegram. His telegram said, "Your letter received, holding executive meeting Tuesday night." But Western Union was having a bad day, and the telegram I actually got said, "Your letter received, holding execution meeting Tuesday night." I accepted this invitation in the full hope that your Southern hospitality would be more civilized. I see by the President's introduction my trust was well placed. Among the many privileges which have been mine over these years, none is more heartwarming to me than to take part in a lectureship which bears the name of Theodore Adams. To some degree, our friendship has covered our respective ministries, and I have had an unbounded admiration and affection for a man who represents the ministry in its fullest possible dimension. There are some lives, you know, that are described by the great words. There are other lives that define the great words. And Theodore Adams' ministry has helped to put new dimension in the definition of great words of faith like pastoral, preaching, and Baptist. I count it a very real privilege to be here on a lectureship that bears his name. Now, there was one qualification which the President overlooked. He doesn't know it, but I'm a man who has bridged the generation gap. It happened inadvertently this way. At a recent family gathering in Boston, where we live, one of our sons forgot his guitar. Now, he lives in Rochester, New York, and when he called and said he'd left it, I said, "Don't worry, I'll bring it the next time I come." So in due time, I got on the MTA, that's our public transportation, to go to the airport carrying his guitar. Now, normally when I'm on the MTA, I'm a non-person. I fit into the background. Young people pay no attention to me, whatever. But I soon discovered that this was going to be a trip of a different kind in more ways than one. I could see two young men across the aisle looking at me, and I could see the processes going on. Just saying, "What is that button-down dude doing with a guitar?" And after a moment of anguished speculation, one of them had a revelation. He shot across the aisle, sat down beside me, and said, "Hey, I bet you're a classical guitarist." I said, "No, I'm just taking this to my son." This took him back a bit. He said, "But you like guitar." I said, "Oh, you bet your life." Then I realized he wouldn't understand that language, so I translated it. I said, "Oh, yeah, man, I'm heavy into guitar." He said, "Is it a 12-string? I searched in my mind for the answer. I remembered my old ukulele had four and got along very well, so I just fuzzed it. I said, "Well, approximately." He said, "What groups do you like?" And I thought, what a fine young man. How did he know I've been in group work all my life? I said, "Well, I always liked the Quakers." He said, "The Quakers, I don't think I ever heard them, but what a name, I can see them now." He said, "Do you like hard rock?" Now, I took geology in college, and I thought all rock was hard. So again, I just took refuge in that phrase which covers all ignorance. I just said, "Well, you know." He said, "Oh, yeah." I hope he knew what we were talking about. I didn't have the remotest idea. When he got off, I said, "See you later, alligator." I don't know why I looked so puzzled. I was speaking his language. When he got off, the car filled up, and I stood up in front of a lovely black girl who looked me over carefully and finally said to me, "You getting tired?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, if you do, you can sit on my lap. I must talk to my doctor about that. I had a sudden seizure of exhaustion." Which I overcame with the greatest reluctance. She said to me, "Do you play that?" I said, "No." She said, "What do you do?" I said, "I'm a minister." She said, "Where's your church?" I said, "Out in Newton." "Do you have a choir?" "Yes." "Could I sing in it?" I said, "Why don't you come out and see?" And I gave her my card. And you know, she rode her 10-speed bike over from Cambridge, about 8 miles, to come to church the next Sunday. From here on, I don't carry a briefcase. I just throw my stuff in a guitar case. It's a new form of evangelism. It's guitar evangelism. You ought to try it. In his book entitled Men Who Made the Nation, John Dos Passos speaks of Alexander Hamilton and the part that he played in the Constitutional Convention. Hamilton came to that convention with a plan for the nation. And while he was personally very popular, his plan was not. And when it became apparent that his plan was not to be accepted by the convention, he picked up his papers and went home. At that point, one of the delegates, Dr. Johnson, a college professor from Connecticut, entered in his notes. He was supported, he was praised by everyone. but supported by none. Now, while that, of course, is a description of a politician in a time of trouble, it is strikingly descriptive of what happens to the prophet in almost every generation. He was praised by everyone, but supported by none. The term prophet has a certain prestige. It even has an aura. And any self-respecting seminary somehow manages to slip into its propaganda that this is a school of the prophets. And when someone mentions to you that you have made a prophetic utterance, it leaves you with a kind of glow. And somewhere in the deepest places of our lives, most of us hope that if the occasion requires, there will come someplace from within the courage, stamina, and grace to speak a prophetic word. But none of that guarantees that that prophetic word will be heard in a secular day. My question is a direct one. Is a prophetic minister possible in a secular culture? There is a biblical story that will help us. In the 18th chapter of Judges, it is recorded that the tribe of Dan got left out when they were passing out territory. They needed a place in the sun. So they did what any self-respecting tribe would do. They appointed a committee. And that committee of five went out to try to find a territory. In their travels, the five came to Ephraim, and in Ephraim, they went to the house of one Micah. Now, Micah had the ultimate in status symbols. He had a priest all his own. Micah was a one-man congregation. Moreover, that priest was a fully pedigreed Levite, and he had all the paraphernalia of his office, an ephod, the teraphim, a molten image, and a graven image. And when the five discovered that there was a priest in the house, they decided to consult him to see whether God looked with favor upon their journey. And when the priest put on the ephod and got out the teraphim and the graven image and the molten image and went through his thing and then said, God does look with favor upon your journey, they concluded that this was indeed a priest of unusual insight. And on their journey, they found confirmation. They went on to a place called Laish and discovered it to be a fertile, green land. Better than that, it had no entangling alliances. So the committee went back to the tribe of Dan, brought in their recommendation that they leave immediately to try to take this territory. So the five returned, this time with 500. And they came again to Ephraim and again to the house of Micah. As they approached the house of Micah, the five stopped the armed troops and said, guess what? You see that house over there? There's a priest there who has an ephod, the teraphim, the molten image, and a graven image. Think well what you shall do. And to a man, they did a column right, stopped again in the front of the house of Micah, and the five went in to take the ephod, the teraphim, the molten image, and the graven image. At this strategic point, the priest came in and he said, what are you doing? And then he got his counsel. They said to him, keep quiet, put your hand on your mouth, and come with us and be to us a father and a priest. Then they added the censure. Is it better to be priest to one man or to a whole tribe? At this point, the priest's ego went on full alert. And consider his dilemma. On one hand, with negative enforcement, the proposition, keep silent, put your hand on your mouth. And over here, what he had never supposed, a magnificent promotion. Is it better to be priest to one man or to a whole tribe? And the priest went into a long season of decision, about 15 seconds. And the story ends as we read that he went off in the midst of the people with his ephod, teraphim, molten image, and graven image. And it said the heart of the priest was glad. Now, is that the option offered to us in this secular day? Keep quiet, put your hand on your mouth, come with us and be to us a father and a priest. The point about that proposition is not that it is to an evil, it is an incomplete good. It's a magnificent calling to be a father and a priest to people. But does it have to be at the cost? Keep quiet, put your hand on your mouth, and come with us. Let's look at those Old Testament prophets for a moment. When the Old Testament prophet said, "Thus saith the Lord," he was appealing to the very center of the power of his society. That was the center around which the whole society was structured, for it was a theocracy. So when the priest said, "Thus saith the Lord," he was calling for the power that was at the center of the culture. He was speaking at the point of the greatest power. The magnificent thing about those ancient prophets was not their power, but the way they used it. Professor James Meilenberg has said that the ancient prophets had several basic considerations. First, they were concerned for the whole political structure of Israel. Second, they had a sharp concern for economic justice. Third, they were concerned for the administration of that justice. Fourth, they called Israel back to the stewardship of the land. And fifth, they had a great distrust of power. Can you think of anything more contemporary than those 5 points, which Professor Meilenberg says were the salient points consistently held by the prophets of Israel? Now let's take a look at the contemporary prophet. Let's see where we are in the secular world. For almost 450 years, we have been in the process of farming out authority. Some of it went to science. Some of it went to the arts. Much of it went to the state. And in our time, some of it is going to alternative moralities. So when the contemporary prophet stands to say, "Thus saith the Lord," the answer comes back, "Which Lord?" Add to it the fact that our contemporary culture has taken on a diversity and expansion that no one could have foreseen. When the ancient prophet spoke expansively, he talked about from Dan to Beersheba. That's a distance of about 100 miles. All of it under the same basic culture. When Dr. Adams and I began our ministries, the expansive phrase was coast to coast. Then it became pole to pole, and now it's planet to planet. All within a lifetime. How shall any contemporary prophet stand and address himself to that multiplicity of authorities, that cacophony of voices, that gathering of gods? Where shall the contemporary biblical prophet speak? I learned this one time when I was pastor near a university. We had what was called Religious Emphasis Week. And we would bring in leading authorities in religion to address the university community. And the best minds began to say, well, that's all right. He or she is an authority in religion, but he doesn't know anything about my field of science or political science or the social sciences or even art. So we decided one time to bring a distinguished scientist, Professor Arthur Compton of Chicago. Dr. Compton was not only an eminent physicist, but a deeply committed Christian. And Professor Compton came and spoke to the university community about the Christian faith. And now the best mind said, oh, that's all right. He's an authority in the field of science. That's his field. But he doesn't really have any authority in the field of religion. And I realized that that biblical story of the Tower of Babel was literally true in this culture of ours. How shall anyone be a prophet in that cacophony of voices, that diversity of authorities? Who shall say to all the gods of our time, thus saith the Lord? It would be an incomparable tragedy if the prophetic voice is not heard. If at last we've come to that point in history where the prophetic voice must be silent, because it cannot address a culture like this, that would be double tragedy. But how shall we do it? I have two suggestions on that. First of all, that as the ancient prophet addressed Israel, the contemporary prophet must address the church. There is a covenant community, the church. There is a people of God, the church. There is a new nation, the successor to Israel, the church. And the contemporary prophet must address himself to that community where I think more than we really know, people do feel the authority of that word, thus saith the Lord. Sometimes it embarrasses them. They squirm under that voice. Story is told of an elder in the Presbyterian Church of Scotland who was very much opposed to the union of the churches of Scotland, but one day got up in assembly to say, I shall vote for this because I am persuaded it is the will of God, but I must say it's highly irregular. There is a community, and the church has to be addressed by the prophet. Oh, you say, that's hopeless. The church can never be prophetic. Let's give it a chance. It is almost clearly discernible in history that it was the voice of the churches that finally brought through the Civil Rights Bill in our country. And in the story of Germany, that tragic hour when 6 million Jews were being put to death in the greatest Holocaust in history, it was the church that stood with any degree of courage. Temporary prophet has a community. Speak to it. Moreover, the contemporary prophet will enter into coalitions with other prophets. There are men and women in this society who will never use the biblical language, but who have held with high purpose to the biblical ethic. When the prophet Elijah began to complain, I am alone, I only am alone, God did something to teach him. He took him out and stood him on a mountain to teach him two things. First of all, the power of a still small voice. And second of all, that he wasn't alone. There are 7,000 others who have not bent the knee to Baal. And in this culture of ours, there are 7,000 others who have not lost the biblical ethic. There's a world of difference between a secular culture that has been leavened by the biblical ethic and biblical faith and that which starts from scratch with sheer materialism. Basically different. Absolutely different. And in our culture, we have a chance to make coalitions with men like E.C. Schumacher in economics, the late Dag Hammarskjöld in international relations, politicians like Mark Hatfield. The church's prophets will stand not alone, but in coalitions with those who will stand even when they don't use the language. And when we stand, what shall we say? What's the prophetic word? I think we shall speak often of idolatry in this culture. Men suppose that when the secular day come, there would move into the center of things a high-minded humanism. What moved in were all the old household gods. Our problem is not atheism, it's polytheism. Whatever your heart clings to or relies upon, said Luther, that properly is thy God. And men's hearts cling to a dozen things where they hope, which they hope will save them. Even our advertising reflects that. We don't advertise products for what they are, but what they'll do for us. A car is something to believe in. I saw an advertisement that looked like a pamphlet on evangelism. Top of the page said, key to a richer life, and hanging right down the middle of that page was the key to a Plymouth car. And then there's that one to stop all others, Dotson Saves, it sets us free. I can see some PhD candidate in the distant future trying to write a PhD candidate, a thesis, on Dotson worship in the 20th century. He found a few fragments somewhere in the ruins. Don't laugh, doctors' dissertations have been written on less. We shall speak often of idolatry. We shall speak of judgment. Not always that judgment that rains fire from heaven, though that's closer than we ever could have dreamed. That's judgment, but that's not the only judgment. Sometimes judgment is not in what happens, but what ceases to happen. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He's tramping out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. That's judgment. I'd know that a mile off. But it's not the only judgment. In the story of Samson, translated by Dr. Moffat, the verse says that when Samson awoke, when the Philistines were upon him, the record says, and he woke up thinking, I will get off as I have done again and again, not knowing that the Eternal had left him. Not knowing, that's judgment too. Tillich has said, can it be that in order to judge the use or misuse of his name in the church, God sometimes creates a silence about himself? It's possible that the greatest judgment upon our culture will not be the raining fire, but finally a kind of ice age of absence. Nothing happened. God no longer brooding on the face of the waters. Dear God, what a judgment that would be. We shall often speak of judgment. Joseph Woodcrutch said that when he went to see plays in New York, he came back feeling that those plays were saying, because there is no grace, there I am. That's a reversal. That's a contemporary confession. We shall speak often of judgment. But we shall moreover speak of grace too. Where did we ever get the idea that a prophetic message is one that lays people out? Where did we ever suppose that denunciation was the mark of the prophet? It's proclamation too. It's holding up hope when there is no hope. It's lighting a light when there is no light. It's saying, comfort ye, my people. And God knows there's little comfort in some quarters in our time. Prophetic word speaks of God's grace, the invitation to return, the waiting Father. That's prophetic too. You say, well, we don't live under the law as Paul did. We don't experience grace. Don't we live under the law? He lived under one, we live under another. Ours is the secular law. It's the awful law of self-sufficiency. Our law is that we ought to be self-sufficient, and our gospel is that we can. And both of those, and this is no blasphemy, both of those are false as hell. And this morning, millions of people started out to their work thinking, if I get one more promotion, I'll have it made. I will become the person I want to become. Many a person is writing a book today not because it's a truth people ought to have, but because it will speak back to him or her to say, you are sufficient. You have it made. Many a person launches into a sexual experience not because it is the enjoyment and celebration of life, but because it at last will say, you are indeed sufficient. And all through this culture of ours, that law of self-sufficiency, that anguish law, is upon us, from which we need to be freed and liberated as much as Paul ever needed to be freed from the law under which he was living. The prophet of today will speak of grace. And finally, we will speak of resurrection. You think we are at a disadvantage over those ancient prophets? We have one incomparable advantage. We preach this side of the resurrection. And now we know that no matter how dark, God has not closed off his options. Saul Bellow in Herzog says, the question is not whether God is dead, but whether death is God. And we have an answer to that. Only God is God. Look at the resurrection. And as long as we preach the resurrection, we preach an incomparable hope. In a great play entitled Becket, there is an exchange between the king and Becket. Becket was the king's friend. He was his drinking buddy. And the king appointed him to be Archbishop of Canterbury in order that he might control the church. And then something began to happen. Becket wasn't the Becket the king had known. And one day beside a seashore, there was a conversation, and Becket said, I am not what I was. And the king says, with sarcasm, have you been touched by grace? And Becket says, not by the one you think. The king says, what then? And Becket says, I had a feeling that I was being entrusted with something in that empty cathedral somewhere in France. On that day when you commanded me to take up this burden, I was a man without honor. And suddenly I found it, one I never thought would be mine, the honor of God. A fragile, incomprehensible honor, as vulnerable as a boy king fleeing from danger. I felt I was being entrusted with something, the honor of God. And in all the workaday coming and going of the average pastor, there's the deep, deep awareness you've been entrusted with something. And it ought to be our daily prayer that if God says, "Be my prophet," we can say, "Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth."
Almighty God, our Father, we came to worship Thee. We have worshiped. We go forth yet as folders of unfinished business. Grant us Thy grace till what we've seen, felt, and heard, and confronted becomes part of the muscle and nerve of our ministries. Through Jesus Christ the Lord.